Welcome to Verse and Voice, the Daily Breadcast.
Great to be diving in again.
Absolutely. You've brought us to, well, a really intense part of the narrative today, Genesis chapter 6.
It's definitely a chapter that raises a lot of questions.
It really does. So our mission here is just to explore this chapter, try to unpack its layers and, you know, pull out the key insights. And we're sticking just to the text itself, Genesis 6.
Sounds good. That's the best place to start.
Okay, let's get into it. So the chapter kicks off by noting a pretty significant change, doesn't it, about the human population?
That's right. Verse 1 tells us, when human beings began to increase in number on the earth, and daughters were born to them. It seems simple, but it really sets the stage.
Sets the stage how? What does that increase imply right at the outset?
Well, it suggests things are changing, maybe rapidly. A growing population often brings complexity, new dynamics, and then there's that specific mention.
The daughters, yeah, and daughters were born to them. Is that just like a demographic fact, or is there something more we should be noticing there?
I think it's key. On the surface, sure, it's demographics. But then you read verse 2 immediately after.
Yeah.
And it's these daughters who become the focus of the next event. So it's not just a throwaway detail. It links directly.
Got it. Okay, so verse 2 then drops this. Well, this really mysterious and much discussed scenario. The sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose.
Yeah, that's the verse that sparks so much debate.
So what are the immediate sort of consequences or implications of these unions, just based on the text right here?
Well, immediately you see this interaction between two distinct groups, sons of God and daughters of humans, whoever they are. And that phrase, married any of them they chose.
Yeah, what about that?
It suggests maybe a power dynamic at play, a lack of restriction perhaps, like choices are being made without considering any established norms or boundaries.
And the text points out their beauty. Why mention that specifically? Is it just description or?
Yeah. It likely highlights the motivation. It seemed to be based on appearance, on physical attraction, which raises questions, doesn't it, about the nature of these unions. Were they just superficial?
Contrasting perhaps with other reasons for relationships.
Exactly. And thinking about how ancient texts often portray motivations for alliances or marriages, beauty is certainly one, but the way it's highlighted here feels significant.
And back to that phrase, married any of them they chose, that lack of limitation you mentioned. What does that tell us about the state of things then, the general vibe?
It paints a picture of maybe a breakdown of order, or perhaps a disregard for existing structures, whether social or, depending on your interpretation, even divine.
Like rules didn't apply.
Something like that. It hints at unchecked power, individuals or groups acting on impulse, maybe without accountability. And you can see how that might lead to problems down the line.
Which seems to happen almost immediately, leading right into the Lord's reaction in verse 3.
Precisely. Verse 3. Then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years.
Okay, so what prompts this? Is it a direct response to verse 2?
It certainly seems directly connected. The timing suggests it's a reaction to these unions and whatever resulted from them. It feels like a line has been crossed.
The spirit will not contend forever. That sounds like a big shift, a change in how God interacts with humanity. What could have led to that point?
Well, contend can mean strive with or judge or even remain in. It suggests that humanity's actions, perhaps these specific actions in verse 2, have created some kind of fundamental break. A resistance, maybe, to divine guidance or presence.
So a limit is reached.
Seems so. A point where the previous mode of interaction is no longer sustainable from the divine perspective.
And then the consequence, the lifespan limit, 120 years. That feels pretty specific and, well, like a major intervention. What's the implication there? Where was humanity heading?
It could be seen as a way to maybe limit the damage, to curtail the long-term potential for whatever negative consequences were arising. It suggests the path humanity was on was flawed, maybe dangerously so, and needed this recalibration, a boundary setting.
Right. Okay. And then right in the middle of this, verse 4 introduces the Nephilim.
Ah, yes. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown.
So the text explicitly links them to those unions from verse 2. What does that tell us about who or what the Nephilim were, according to this passage?
It strongly suggests they are the offspring of these unions. Their origin is tied directly to the sons of God and daughters of humans.
Yeah.
This implies they were seen as different, Maybe extraordinary in some ways, size, strength, something.
And then they're called heroes of old, men of renown. That sounds almost positive, admiring even.
It does, doesn't it? And that's where it gets really interesting, especially when you compare it to what comes next.
How so?
Well, you have this description, heroes, renown chorus, which sounds like human admiration, right? People looked up to them, maybe. Mm. But then you contrast that with the Lord's perspective in the very next verses.
Which is not so positive.
Not at all. It highlights a potential clash between human values, maybe valuing power or fame and divine judgment, which seems focused entirely on moral character, on the heart.
That's a really key tension. And what about that little bit? And also afterward, it says they were on the earth in those days and afterward.
Yeah, that parenthesis is intriguing. It opens up questions. Does it mean these kinds of unions happen again later? Or did the term Nephilim get used later for other powerful figures? Or maybe their legacy just persisted.
It leaves the door open a bit.
It does. It suggests this wasn't necessarily just a contained one-off event in deep history. Its effects, or something like it, might have continued.
Okay, so moving from the Nephilim to verse 5, the mood shifts drastically. It's stark.
Very stark. The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth.
And that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil all the time.
Wow, how great the wickedness had become. That suggests an escalation, right?
Definitely. It implies a process, a worsening state. And you have to wonder, how did it get so bad?
Can we connect it back to the earlier verses? The unions, the Nephilim, the power dynamics?
It seems very likely the narrative wants us to see a connection. Perhaps the breakdown of boundaries mentioned in verse 2, maybe the influence or actions of the Nephilim, or the values they represented, it all contributed to this snowballing corruption.
A slippery slope kind of situation.
Possibly, where initial compromises or transgressions led to a complete decay.
And that phrase, every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil all the time. I mean, that's absolute, utterly devastating.
It is. It's not just about bad actions anymore. It's about the very source of action, the thoughts, the intentions, the heart. It's described as completely corrupted, pervasively evil.
Painting a picture of humanity utterly turned away from good.
That seems to be exactly the picture, a profound inner corruption, which naturally leads to the Lord's reaction in verse 6.
Right. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled.
God regretted. That's a powerful, almost shocking word to use. How should we approach understanding that emotion here?
It's profound. It's generally not understood as God admitting a mistake, like, oops, shouldn't have done that, but more as expressing immense sorrow, profound grief, and deep disappointment.
Like a parent's heartbreak.
Perhaps that's a helpful analogy. It's the pain of seeing something created with good intention turn so thoroughly toward destruction and self-destruction. It's about the outcome, not a flaw in the initial act of creation.
And his heart was deeply troubled. It adds to that sense of emotional weight.
Absolutely. It emphasizes this isn't a cold, detached judgment. It's coming from a place of deep pain and sorrow over the state of humanity. The seriousness is palpable.
And that sorrow leads directly to the decision in verse 7.
Yes. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them.
The scope is just total. Not just humans, but animals, birds, everything that moves on the ground. Why include them?
It suggests a deep interconnectedness in this worldview. Humanity's corruption hasn't just affected humans. It's somehow tainted or implicated the entire earthly creation they inhabit.
So the solution has to be comprehensive, too.
Apparently so. It speaks to the severity of the problem. It's seen as having fundamentally damaged the whole system.
And that repetition at the end of verse 7, for I regret that I have made them, it really hammers home the reason, that deep sense of sorrow.
It does. It bookends the decision, reinforcing the motivation rooted in profound disappointment and grief, not anger alone.
But then, after all that darkness and judgment, verse 8 arrives.
A crucial turning point. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord.
Just that simple sentence, what does it suggest, found favor, about Noah?
It immediately sets him apart. In the midst of universal wickedness, Noah is different. It implies righteousness, faithfulness, something that caught God's attention in a positive way. He stood out.
An exception.
The exception. And it's this favor that changes everything. It introduces hope into a seemingly hopeless situation.
It really acts as the pivot for the whole story moving forward, doesn't it? From destruction to potential preservation.
Exactly. Without verse 8, the story ends very differently. It's the hinge that swings the narrative towards the ark, the flood, and the continuation of life. It shows that even in widespread judgment, individual faithfulness matters.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into just Genesis 6, it's amazing how much is packed in there.
It really is. From population growth, those mysterious unions, the Nephilim,
to this overwhelming assessment of wickedness, the divine sorrow, the decision to destroy, and then that glimmer of hope with Noah.
We've touched on these huge themes, the nature of humanity, power, judgment, grief, grace, all in 8 verses.
What stands out most to you as we've walked through it again today? Any particular element?
You know, I think it's still that tension around the Nephilim, described as heroes of renown by human standards, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
While at the same time, the overall context is this slide into utter wickedness in God's eyes. That gap between human perception and divine assessment is really striking.
Yeah, that difference in perspective is powerful. It makes you think.
Definitely.
Well, Genesis 6 certainly leaves us with a lot to mull over. Profound questions about judgment, human nature, corruption, and consequences. It's been interpreted countless ways, of course.
And likely will continue to be.
We hope this focused look has sparked some thoughts. What further questions does exploring just this chapter raise for you listening? Maybe consider how these ancient words, this narrative, might resonate with our own understanding of the world, human behavior, and maybe that interplay between choices and outcomes today.
Food for thought, for sure.